made it to me.
Good evening, Herb. It's kind of good to see you here at the controls, at the massive console, producing these enormous sounds of life. Oh, we would like to salute the Boston Globe, if we may, tonight for the misprint of the year so far. Oh, it's a goodie. It's a picture of Charlton Heston here in the Globe. That's a Boston paper. It's often considered almost as good a humor paper as the Philadelphia Inquirer, but yes, which runs runs right behind the New York Daily News. But here we have Charlton Heston, and you know, it's about the Oscars that are coming up. You know, it says Charlton Heston will serve as a master of ceremonies for the 45th annual Academy Awards presentations in Hollywood, the 27th of March. Heston, who won an Oscar in 1959 as Best Actor for his performance in Ben-Hur, has appeared as a celebrity three times on the Oscar show, but will be faking his first appearance as Master of Ceremonies. Would you please? Oh, the telephone calls that are going back and forth between the agents now. What do you mean my client is going to be faking his first appearance as a Master of Ceremonies?
Gee, we try to catch those things in the linotype before we print them, but...
That's all right. Nobody's going to say my client is faking his way. Even if he is, my guy, they're not going to say it. Well, thank you. I like the idea you're faking your way through. You know, one of the greatest misprints I ever personally... You know, you see a lot of misprints that are occasionally reprinted, you know, down at the bottom of the New Yorker magazine or something. Once in a while, you catch one yourself. And one of the best ones that I've seen ever myself was reading a paper out in Cincinnati, and it had a description of a disturbance that occurred out there, and the disturbance involved a lot of people, and it says the police arrived, and to disperse the crowd, they fired shotguns in the air over the crowd. Only there was a misprint. La dee dee, la da 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 da, la da da. That would be an exciting weapon to use as a crowd controlling device. Yeah, that would certainly stop a lot of riots in a hurry, I'll tell you. Dee dee dee, la da dee dee. That was kind of a great one. Yeah, and then there was another one. It was a kind of another great one. It said, there was a description of a wedding. You know how they always describe weddings and the dresses that the girl wears. You know, very involved, a high big society wedding in Cincinnati, and described her dress. It says the dress was an original creation of Givenchy or some very elegant designer. It says this dress was a very elegant dress. It was flown over from Paris. And it had tiny pearls sewed into the bodice, and it was an original created just for this wedding. That said, what made it unusual was that it was decorated with scalloped hams. I thought, that is a hell of an unusual dress. Now, I can see what they meant, of course, was H-E-M-S. But just one little word, you know, one little letter made the whole difference. And then, having known the bride, though, I say it was kind of descriptive because she had scalloped hams anyway, so a large lady. But these things you take in stride. I think a lot of misprints are not really misprints. I think they're Freudian slips. And I think that the idea that this guy said that Charlton Heston was faking his way through the ceremony, the master of ceremonies role, probably said something about the linotype operator and his feeling about Charlton Heston as an actor. So, hey, you know, we'd like to salute this kind of a sad little note that's come out today. You know, you can just see all of life is in newspapers. You don't have to read novels to get what life is about. Most people tend to go to movies and read novels to see what life is all about, or get books by Dr. Rubin to find out about sex. But all you got to do is read the papers. I mean, tell you, it's all there. It's all there. Will Rogers was right. In fact, you remember he said, it's all I know is what I read in the papers, was his famous line. Well, if you know all that's in the papers, man, you know everything about life, because it's all there. For example, here's one of life's minor tragedies, a commentary on contemporary society. This is from the Evening Bulletin of Philadelphia. 3 years ago in Titusville, Pennsylvania, Willie Hunter, do you remember Willie Hunter? We talked about Mr. Hunter a couple of seasons back. Was well known in the Crawford County town of Titusville and received a trophy for attending 3,000 funerals. He was a fantastic funeral goer and would attend maybe 7 or 8 a day. You remember I talked about him? Well, in fact, he was cited by the city's funeral directors as the greatest funeral goer of them all. Well, you know, fans get recognized these days. I mean, they have Fan Day out at Yankee Stadium. They have Fan Day when the Knicks play occasionally, you know. And he's a funeral fan, or was. It says he was cited by the area's funeral directors. The inscription on the trophy reads, and the trophy is still in existence, it says, "For meritorious mourning service." An unsurpassed reviews at funeral homes. Yes, sir, a great, great mourner and a great funeral goer. He passed on to his reward this weekend, last weekend, actually, at 66. His trophy was buried with him, by the way. And the saddest line of all is at the bottom of the news note. His funeral was attended by 9 persons. I mean, that's what I call one of life's minor tragedies, you know. A great funeral goer, nobody comes. But this is the way life is, you know. You just can't. Now, take, for example, before we go any further, how about let's doing a House of Chan spot, you know, life little irony. Jerry Lambert, my producer, went down to eat there. Did you have good food there? Is it fine? Well, you look like you're wondering whether you did or not. What the hell is this? I mean, yeah. Well, you don't order a cheeseburger at the House of Chan, and that's what you persist in doing. I mean, sweet and sour cheeseburgers are not exactly their specialty. Well, anyway, I like it. And for those of you who have never visited the House of Chan, you can on and see why I have trouble with my producers. Food is a little bit above them, I think. It's a little too esoteric. And for those of you who enjoy good Chinese food, really good, you know, I would suggest you go down to the House of Chan, or up, depending on where you live. It's at 52nd. Well, see, I always think of up, you know. I live in the village all the time, and I always think of going uptown. But it's 52nd and 7th Avenue, right? Right in the heart of the Ding Dong District. And you'll love it. Food's good. They're open 7 days a week. It's the House of Chan. This is where Charlie got that tremendous alderman that he carried around with him and all those pictures. You know, it isn't an alderman. He's not necessarily a politician. That's a bay window. And the food is elegant. It's good. And they have 22 chefs standing at attention by their woks, ready to do your merest, slightest oriental bidding. It's inscrutably delicious, their food. That's 52nd and 7th, right in the heart of the theater district. In fact, if you're going to a show, make sure that you hop down there before you go in, have dinner there. And tell them you're going to a show, because they'll get you out in time. That's 52nd and 7th, 7 days a week. Food is great. They're open at midnight, and they have a barzy. You can get a drinky poo before you're... And don't ask for one of their sweet and sour martinis. They're terrible. Ask for the regular martini. It's good. There, we did that real nice. And now here's a word from the California Prune Advisory Board, and they will give you some very fine advice on prunes.
Hi, friends. This is Terry McGovern with a message from California Prunes, the funny fruit that does so much for you. Prunes are loaded with vitamins. In fact, pound for pound, they've got 8 times the vitamin A of the leading fresh fruit. And more niacin and vitamin B2 than the 6 most popular fruits. And here's something you girls might be interested in.
What Terry's trying to say, folks, is that pound for pound, prunes have more iron, niacin, and vitamin B2 than the 6 most popular fresh fruits. They're loaded with pure, natural fruit sugar to give you quick energy to help you make it through the day. And what's more, Prunes do great things for your complexion. I'm sure I speak for Terry when I say, try some California prunes. The funny fruit that does so much for you.
How did you do that?
Terry.
These are the sounds of wild timber wolves, now almost extinct in America. Because man feared them, he killed them. Yet not once in our history has there been a documented case of wolves attacking a human being. Wolves have a necessary place in nature. They weed out weak and diseased animals of other species. That way, only the strong breeders continue the line. Without wolves, our deer and caribou would diminish. Now, perhaps just in time, movements have started to protect the wolf, and the American Museum of Natural History is giving its full support. Come see our exhibition, Never Say Die. It is the story of wolves and other endangered species. The American Museum of Natural History, 79th and Central Park West, open every day.
You know, you talk about little things in the paper. I see, here's a note, Miss Faith Lentz will get a free pass to the Hogle Zoo. And that's out in the, you know, things are happening all over, you know. This is the SLC Tribune, whatever that is. You know what the SLC Tribune is? People, I guess, think they know, you know, where they live. You know, I don't know, one of my spies says this, and it says it's from the SLC's, what? Los Angeles? Southern, I don't know, SLC Tribune. But anyway, it's a note from the SLC Tribune. Where is the Hogle Zoo? That's where the Hogle Zoo is, wherever that paper comes out. I never heard of the Hogle Zoo. Salt Lake City, yeah, very good. My God, you're probably right, absolutely. Excellent, yeah. Miss Faith Lentz. We'll get a free pass to the Hogle Zoo next time she visits there. She was locked in the snake house Sunday night when the zoo began closing down for the day. Yeah, everybody left, and she was still fooling around with the snakes. And the place is closed up, and there she is with the boa constrictors and the hooded cobras. She couldn't even get out of the snake house. She tried the telephone. You know, she picked up the phone. And she didn't realize it, but the phone, I didn't know this either, the phone was wired to an alarm. Apparently, after the lights go out in the zoo, everything is wired for, you know, for dingbats that get in there and try to wrestle polar bears and stuff. So the phone was alarmed, hooked up as an alarm, and she picked up the phone, and it began to ring, which made all the snakes nervous. And when the snakes are nervous in the snake house, at night, when you're in there all by yourself, you tend to get a little nervous yourself. She bent a door frame with a chair, removed the pane of glass, and finally struggled free. Mrs. Lentz said she was talking to another woman and a child and suddenly discovered she was all alone in the building. Locked in a snake house. And they gave her a free pass. That's a terrible gift. I mean, you'd think she'd see enough of the snake house. I mean, that way, but these are the little things. Now, you see, this is a typical example of life in action. It cannot be predicted. And the idea of being locked in a snake house is a good premise for a short story by a black humorist type writer. See, it's The Night in the Snake House. And you could build a whole thing, you know, Kurt Vonnegut style. Which is a little obvious, of course, but you're giving the people what they want. This is the stuff they... by the way, the next time I read a review or a report or a commentary that brings up incessantly what is called man's predicament. What the hell is man's predicament? How many times have you seen that in a review? Man's predicament. Once again, we were thrilled to the core as we read Samantha Hogleswan's magnificent novel, I, A Petal Falling in the Water, as she illustrates in searing tones today's predicament facing mankind. Well, what is the predicament? You know, what is the predicament? A predicament means that you have a choice. Actually, you know, not necessarily. What is a predicament? You know, and whenever I start reading a review and it deals with man's predicament, I just hum quietly and go on to the racing news. And I'm not even interested in racing. This is WOR New York. But man's predicament. Jerry, you read all those reviews all the time. You're constantly reading the New York Magazine and all that. Yeah. And between talking about Rex Reed and man's predicament, they cover the entire week. Oh, no, they talk about Rex Reed, man's predicament, and Clay Felker. So in between the three, you know, they got it pretty well taped. But, you know, speaking of, I noticed that magazine has fulfilled William Randolph Hearst's old dicta. You know who Hearst was? He was the guy, you know, the yellow journalism star. And his great dicta was, give them plenty of sex and crime, and it'll be, you'll do all right. And in other words, he was describing success in the publishing world. And I've noticed that's pretty much the way they've gone, sex and crime. But different kind. Their sex is not the Daily News type. It's, can modern marriages survive? Dr. Rubin discusses the intimate details with pictures illustrated with line drawings and foldouts. And now that's not called sex in contemporary. That's called information. It's basic tools for living. I don't know. And then that's interspersed between articles like I Barricaded My Door, a searing expose of life on 8th Street, and the corruption of today's police force, and I fought with the Black Panthers, you know. Or next week, Inside the Mafia. Well, this is an old dicta. No, nothing wrong with it. I think Mr. Hearst was onto it. He said it. La da dee 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 dee, la da dee dee dee. End of commentary. Dee dee dee. That commentary. But, yeah, you know, that's what the movies are about. Give them plenty of sex and crime, and they'll come by the millions. And that's always been the case. But, of course, it's disguised. It's never said that it's, you know, if somebody just came out and really honestly had little boxes, you know, departments in their magazines or in their reviews. And, you know, like today, you pick up the any review magazine, like the New York Times, and they're always listed under mystery. Contemporary society and stuff. Now, those are awfully big, very, very loose definitions. And it would be kind of great if they just listed them, you know, sex, sadism, you know, polemics, and listed them under the various issues that they really deal with. I'm talking about books. Don't look so confused, Herb. We are confused because you don't often read those things. They don't have those catalogs. They don't have that kind of thing in the Allied catalog. I'm sorry, you know, or the Heath catalog. But all jesting aside, though, stop and think about it. How long has it been since you have seen a movie that did not include either sex or crime or a combination of both? I'm just asking a question. I'm talking about a contemporary movie. I mean, you may go once in a while and see a Laurel and Hardy festival or something like that. But I'm talking about a contemporary picture, sex or crime or both. Now, the crime can be many different types of crime. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, a guy shooting another guy. The crime can be such things as, let's say, political. Hey, have you observed now that there's a rash of badly done jewel thief murderer type slash films? And they all involve exactly the same gimmick. Somebody is always lowered down from a skylight wearing what appears to be a rubber suit. That's, I don't know why they wear that rubber suit all the time, but they're always lowered down from a skylight wearing a rubber suit and involving some kind of suction cups where they lift the top off the thing, you know, and they reach in. And it's all about thwarting the security system, right? You've seen that? How many of those have you seen recently? Dozens of them. That's called the Topkapi syndrome. And it's been going on and on. They just lower them down. And there's another type of movie now that's become very prevalent now. It's the folksy private eye or and/ detective. That's called the Columbo complex. You know who Columbo is, Peter Falk. The folksy, foot shuffling, clod kicking type of folksy private eye. You know, he says, "Shucks, I don't know what I'm doing here, but ma'am, I'd just like to ask you one question. Just one question. Where was you the night of the murder? I know, of course, it's just for the records, but this is the new. Have you seen it? How many of those have you seen? You haven't, Jerry. That's true. But then again, you're still deep in the modern Museum of Modern Art world, and this is a very different thing that's going on. Get out there once and see what's happening. Get out there once and see what's going on. And, of course, the various variations that lie within that. You can have a folksy sheriff from Taos, New Mexico, who is magically somehow on assignment with the 23rd Precinct, and he keeps walking around wearing his big 10-gallon hat and say, "Well, folks, I don't know anything about these big city police methods, but back in Taos, the way we do it, I call Ben up on the phone, then I get out my .45, so that's one variation. Then you have the Peter Falk variation, which is a kind of a, I'm Lieutenant Columbo of the police force, and I just want to ask a little question here. My wife was talking the other night. I know it's silly, but I have to. This is that variation. Then now there's the black variation. So you have the black folksy detective, which is another one. That's the new development. So I'm just saying that things go in waves. They come in waves. You know, it's like the flu bug will attack the nation for a while, and then it'll disappear. It'll be replaced by Egyptian measles. It'll come for a while, and then that'll disappear. So we're right now in the middle of the jewel thief thing, and of course. For a while there, you remember here a year or so ago, I should have reported, a year or so ago, we had a wave of aging rodeo riders. The aging rodeo rider? Why is it I happen to know all these things and everybody's looking confused? You mean you haven't seen any one of seven movies by Steve McQueen and Cliff Robertson, all of whom were aging rodeo stars, who make their one last try at the big bull? And of course, there's the scene where he rides the big Brahma in Madison Square Garden in slow motion, with the Sam Peckinpah gore thrown in, this is always very exciting, that was a wave which I should have reported on at the time, but the current wave of Topkapi scenes is contemporarily with us. Of course, there's another one too, and that is there's a new type of detective emergence that I would like to report on. It's an emerging. It's the racial ethnic detective. We've now got one Italian detective, Columbo. We have one Polish detective, Banachek. We have one black detective, Tenafly. We have there are about three ethnic type detectives that are making it big, and of course we're going to run the whole gamut. There will be a Hungarian detective. Of course, that will not come about until we have Hungarian jokes. See, all of these various detective series are based on those jokes. So Banachek is always making Polish jokes. And nobody else can make them. Only a Pole can. So Polish jokes are always being whipped out by Banachek. And Italian jokes always keep popping up. And Columbo is an Italian, see. So, we'll have to wait, though, when, you know, Hungarian jokes start, and we'll have a Hungarian detective who will go around making Hungarian jokes, you know, about goulash and stuff. the idea of the ethnic detective is not really that new. As a matter of fact, Charlie Chan was an ethnic detective. Deep-dyed ethnic detective. In fact, he was always making Chinese and or Chairman Mao little red book statements, proverbs, you know, Confucius say. You know, he was always saying, whenever there was a moment of tenseness in the drama, he would stop and say, ancient wisdom say, he who panic in moment of danger will be first to go way of beheaded snake. This is a that would be the, you know, typical. Yeah. You could ad lib these by the hundreds, you know. You just sit there and ad lib them. And that was in effect a Chinese joke. It was a Chinese joke of a certain type. In fact, did you know that at one time they even had these? A running comic strip used to have a Confucius say bit. You remember that? Sure, you do, Herb. Of course you do. And that was always a Confucius say. And it was a kind of a mild Chinese joke of the with mild philosophical overtones. But another one. Who was another great ethnic detective? Well, Peter Lorre, of course. Who did he play? Why do I know all these things about movies? And you're supposed to be the film buff. You mean to tell me you never saw Mr. Moto? Of course, Mr. Moto at the Olympics. Mr. Moto pursue evildoer to Riviera. That was Peter Lorre, although he didn't use that accent. That was more of a Sidney Toler accent, who was Charlie Chan for a good long time. He was always saying, number one son, remember that? Number one son, please report to police lieutenant immediately. Give yourself up. remember those? Another great scene, of course, in all the Charlie Chan movies was that big moment when Chan would say, I beg your indulgence. All members present at a very elegant dinner party. I beg your indulgence. I must make announcement. Will you please close door ahead of dining room, please. And please close window to avoid unpleasantness. And now must make announcement, please. Someone present at this dinner party commit the murder. Someone here at this dinner party is guilty of the murder. And we will proceed now to analyze and decide who commit murder. And you remember that big moment when all the people would look at each other? Who did it, you know? And everybody looked nervous, of course. So you knew that everybody had done it. He said, first we must eliminate those who were certainly not able to perpetrate crime due to situations they found themselves in. To begin with, we must eliminate Miss Carruthers. Miss Carruthers, we know at the time, was unconscious due to blow upon back of head. Since murder occurred at 10:18 and Miss Carruthers was found at 10:17 with blow upon back of head, we must eliminate Miss Carruthers. Now, you remember those? Great moments, you know. And Key Luke was saying, Hey, Dad, what about... He said, attention, son. Please. Impetuosity, always sign of youth. Same thing happened to Spring Chicken, wind up in pot. Right? You can see I've mastered the medium. But these are all part of the great literature that we live by. And it hasn't changed much. The only thing that's changed, of course, is we've substituted a Polish detective for a Chinese detective. Chinese are kind of out of style now, as private eyes. I haven't seen a good Chinese private eye in a long time. That doesn't mean they won't come back. Oh no, they're, you know, because eventually there's going to be a big movement called it'll be called Peking Power or China Power or something. Then we'll have a whole raft of those. But nevertheless, the Chinese. I'm sorry, I don't recall any leading Japanese. detective in the movies. Or was Mr. Moto one? I don't know. What was he? He was just sort of an amorphous Oriental. I don't know. Was Mr. Moto Chinese or Japanese? And do you remember Mr. Moto? I wonder who can tell me who wrote Mr. Moto's stories. Very famous writer wrote them. You know who wrote them? They were taken from a series of novels, you know. Who wrote them? Well, I'll tell you who wrote them. Why do I know these bits of... This is true trivia, by the way. People who think trivia is who played the second gangster from the left in the High Sierras with the... That's not trivia, really. That's just movie stuff, you know. But the true trivia is who wrote the Charlie Chan mysteries. Who wrote them? You mean you don't even know that? You know, that's the way fame is. These guys, it's too bad. You know, a guy will create something that will even become part of the language. Really, seriously, become part of the language. And people all over the world know who Charlie Chan is. And yet, here my two intellectuals in the control room have no idea who wrote the Charlie... Who created? There was one guy. There was no Charlie Chan until this guy thought him up. It wasn't Warner Oldham that thought him up, or Sidney Toler, or the movies who thought him up. This guy thought him up. And who was it? Well, that'll be your homework for tonight. These are the people that really contributed to 20th century life. I mean, you know, a guy that would create the Charlie Chan. That's your homework for tonight. I'm not going to tell you. Who created, then, Mr. Moto? Which were not as well known, but I'll give you this clue, that he wrote them for kicks, and he came from a somewhat aristocratic family. And since he did come from an aristocratic family, he was literally drummed out of the aristocratic family because he was writing cheap detective novels on the side for kicks. and that should give you a clue to him. Because his other novels were about elegant society, and they were very serious classical novels about elegant society. I won't tell you. This guy has like a split personality. On the one hand, he wrote these novels of Brahmin society, and the other hand, he wrote Mr. Moto, and his family was very embarrassed about his detective stories. Okay, I'll ask you another one, since I happen to know these two guys, you know, the names of them. Who wrote who created Tarzan? Well, that's right. Now you know that one. Yeah. Okay. You know who created Tarzan. Oh, but here's a better one. All right. Now we're taking great classical pop figures, you know, of our time. Of our time, meaning the 20th century. And they still persist. Who created Lassie? Lassie was created by a person. There was no such dog ever as Lassie. And he created Lassie. Who was it? Uh-huh. You don't know, do you? Now, there's fame, you know. These guys created really great characters. And by great, I mean everybody in the country knows about them, even if you like... It doesn't matter whether you like them or dislike them. We're not making any value judgments. They're universal characters. They're universally known. And they're even almost in the language. Lassie. And all right, we'll ask you another one. You like this, don't you? Okay. Who created... this one is not, of course, as well known. It is as well known, but it's not talked about much. The author doesn't get much credit. But who created Black Beauty? Now, you're pretty close. Black Beauty. Now that one is, by the way, is on television now, that character. These are all characters that have, you know, are part of the TV world. We'll ask you a goodie here. This is a real goodie. A series just went off. A Western series just went off. And it was one of the oldest television shows in America and one of the most successful in America. It was based on a radio show, which was even better. And it was that radio show, by the way, was primarily based on a novel. What was it? No, I'll give you a clue. It was set in the West. And very few people ever recognize that, you know, the novel upon which the thing is based. But almost all of these things, the great classic ones, have originally started as a... You know, these... Sure. Some guy created some characters, and somebody liked them, and the next thing you know, it went into television and movies and comic strips and the whole bit, and went all the way out. All the way. That's true also... In a curious way of comic strips you take guys like guys that create a fantastic character. Now I'll have to point out something. The reason that I know about these things is that it's not because I was contemporary or anything of this stuff, because a lot of these things were written a long time ago, but because I was fascinated for a while at one point in my... And when I was going to college, I got fascinated with the creators. This was sometime before it was really hip to dig pop culture. I've been doing it on the air for some time, talking about it long before it became a big deal. And I was fascinated at one time with people who created universal characters from whatever medium they were in. Now, They are a fascinating lot, and they're largely unknown to people. That is, the people who even know about the characters. For example, I don't think many people would know. Here's a universal character, for example. There's a universal character, Popeye. Now, Popeye is a universal character. A man created Popeye. He thought of Popeye. He also created Wimpy. He created Olive Oil, that whole cast of characters, which have become sort of an integral part of the culture. In fact, they even have Wimpy burger stands and all that. And I wonder how many people walking up to a Wimpy... You've seen Wimpy burger stands? I wonder how many people even know who Wimpy is or was. You know? They think it was some guy that started a bunch of hamburger stands one time. So the idea is here's a guy, again, a contributor, but very few people know his name. Who created Skeezix? Skeezix. There's another character who is... these are all, I think, in the same line with guys that created Charlie Chan, guys that created Mr. Moto, Tarzan. These are all great classical figures in our pop culture. All right, here's a goodie. Who created King Kong? King Kong is from a novel. That'll come as a shock to all of you. All right? How do you like that one? I'll lay that one on you. There was no King Kong, believe me, before this person wrote a novel about it, which later became a movie, of course, and that's what everybody knows. But the idea of, you know, the King Kong character was created by somebody. That threw you, didn't it? Speaking of great fictional characters, we just mentioned Charlton Heston, right? He got an Academy Award for playing a great fictional character that's been in many, many movies. There never was a Ben-Hur, you know. That's a fictional character. Who created him? Now, that's a very interesting story. That is really an interesting story, that one. Who created Ben-Hur? We'll leave you to think about that one for a while. And that is a fascinating story because of what the guy's previous career had been. Uh-huh. So there are a lot of fictional characters. I wonder how many people know who created Rhett Butler. And Scarlett O'Hara. You know, we just think Scarlett O'Hara was there all the time. A most, logical character. You know who Scarlett O'Hara was, of course, in Gone with the Wind. Who actually created Scarlett O'Hara? And it was not the actress who played it, nor did Rhett Butler. He wasn't created by Daryl Zanuck or whoever it was that produced it, and Clark Gable, who did the thing. Who created these two characters? You know? And I'll tell you another sidelight about this person, another odd sidelight. This is the only book this person ever wrote. Just like that. Laid a biggie on the crowd and left. All right, I'll ask you another one. We've seen, how many times have you seen another great classical character? Is Mr. Roberts. You know Mr. Roberts? Great classical character. You know, you've seen the, you know, there was a stage play and a movie and all that, and Henry Fonda was Mr. Roberts. Very interesting character. Who created Mr. Roberts? It was not Henry Fonda, I'm sorry. There's another guy that created a kind of, he wasn't as big, but he was kind of a popular, kind of a folk character, Mr. Roberts. Who was he? Who created that guy? And he's remained, you know, sort of in the literature since. And these characters, of course, you know some of the more obvious ones, like Lil Abner, you know who created him, but that's an obvious character. But because the guy himself, in other words, the creator, sought publicity and got it for himself. But on the other hand, who created, this will give you kind of a thing, who created Terry and the Pirates? Who created Terry? Another character, Smiling Jack. Who? Here's one for you. One of the great folk heroes of all time. I mean, he's involved. They even had a series of movies about him. Who created Dick Tracy? That's right. Who played him in the movie? Did you know there was a whole series of bad movies made about Dick Tracy? Yeah, you saw those. I was thinking about them. But who played him? There you go. Who created another great character of that type? Boston Blackie. Boston Blackie. Remember Boston Blackie? Yeah, well, all right. Now, the only reason I did this is if you think you know something about pop culture, you better regroup. Regroup. Regroup, gang. Did you enjoy that? Well, you know, these are guys that nobody talks much about, you know. And don't immediately flood me with letters telling me about the time you saw a Boston Blackie movie. Nothing to do with that. Because I must admit that I've, at one time in college, spent two semesters writing a major paper on these characters. So my knowledge comes from cheating. I studied. Right up there. But they are important people, you know. They disappeared kind of in the vast disappearing sea of instant anonymity, even though their character lives on, they created. All right, here's one you all know. We even named mustaches and everything after his character. Who created Dr. Fu Manchu? Dr. Fu Manchu. Now, some of his great descriptions were fantastic. Let's say, I am Dr. Fu Manchu. I am bound upon world domination. I believe my superior intellect deserves to rule the world. Who created that great character? Okay, you got your homework cut out for you, gang. Yeah.